I'm the presiding judge for these arguments. To my right is the Honorable Nancy Lichtenstein, and to my left is the Honorable Sean Conley. We comprise Division 7 for the purposes of this oral argument. We have two arguments for our docket this afternoon. The first of these is, and please let me know if I'm mispronouncing the names, Horan versus Yannanek. Are counsel for that case present? The second is Sawyer versus Pelfrey. Are counsel for that case present?
Your Honor, those attorneys have not yet checked.
All right, very good. We shall call the first case, which is Horan versus Yannanek, and also Brandon 2. Is counsel for Brandon 2 here? Okay, is counsel for Yannanek here?
Yes, sir.
Have you gentlemen decided on what you're going to do with your time?
Yes, we have.
All right, and what is that?
Mr. Kepler is going to use the first 10 minutes, and I'm using the last 5.
All right, if you please come forward and be seated at counsel table. And in the course of doing that, I'd like to ask counsel if they have received the one-page summary of our procedures that we mail out to all counsel. All right.
Yes, sir.
Anybody have any questions about those procedures? No, hearing none, okay. Last thing is, before we get going, if you have a cell phone or a pager that will make noise if it goes off, please turn it off or put it on silent. We don't want it to disturb counsel during their arguments. That being said, we are ready to proceed with Horan versus Yannanek. Oh, and by the way, before I forget, just to let counsel know, I understand that there is an this is important to both counsel. There's a 54C issue, and we certainly want counsel to address that. But we also would like to have counsel address the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act issue in the course of oral arguments, please. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I will reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel. It's up to you to watch your time. I won't let you know, okay? Thank you.
My name is Joseph Coleman. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Kathy Horan, registration number 6856. This case involves Kathy Horan, who was an individual who would locate property, expend money for land planning, surveying, engineering, and then market the property. She would market it to a actual developer who then would do the actual dirt work. Ms. Horan negotiated approximately a $1.3 million sale price for all of her real estate interests. She sold it to an entity called Tricord. Tricord was an LLC made up of the three individual named defendants in this case: Brandon, Baker, and Yannanek. The other party, and they negotiated the price, the $1.3 million. The final party being Brandon 2. Brandon 2 is the one that ultimately acquired all the properties from Tricor and forms the basis of the fraudulent transfer contention. The evidence also showed that Brandon 2 came in with Tricor as a partner to try to make money developing the property. The sequence of events, the transaction in question started in December of 2006, where Mr. Stoner receives a promissory note for $785,000 signed by the three individuals: Tricord, the entity, and Brandon 2, the entity, are not mentioned, nor are they parties to that transaction. In January of 2007 is basically when the transaction between Tricord and Ms. Horan starts to occur, or actually, for purposes of this litigation, starts to occur. That's where she agreed upon, and with precisely $1,330,000, I'll just refer to it as a $1,300,000 as an approximate. The $1,300,000 debt. $780,000 was paid to her. $550,000 was a seller carry promissory note. By April of 2007, the dispute starts to arise, at which time Tricord starts denying its obligations on the debt. Initially unknown to Ms. Horan, Tricord also commences its conduct of dissipating all of its real property assets. It starts deeding the properties to Brandon too. There were four deeds ultimately. Two of them were recorded in the April timeframe. Ultimately, when all four deeds were transferred, two of which occurred in October of that same year and two in April, Tricord was left a shell with its real property and assets gone.
Let me ask you that, counsel, because that seems to be contrary to the finding. I would have assumed that was the case, but the trial court, in considering whether it was substantially all of Tricord's assets, said there was no evidence presented on that.
The evidence was shown that it transferred all of its real property. What the court's getting at is we did not get evidence in as to whether it had other assets. The reason being that the request for admissions had been confirmed by the court at the commencement of trial, and the court basically said the only issue remaining that the plaintiff needed to prove was to prove actual that she was a creditor and that she incurred damages.
Isn't that as to Tricord? You're talking about Brandon 2 now. The admissions of Tricord don't apply to Brandon 2, do they?
Well, I thought about Tricord, and I was answering in the context of Tricord. We didn't go into Tricord because, as you can tell, we couldn't get much discovery. And we then relied upon what the court told us, that to prove the fraudulent transfer of Tricord, all we had to prove was that we were a creditor and that we incurred damages. So we did not pursue any real detailed further evidence from Tricord. Furthermore, the proving of insolvency is not a necessary element in a case of actual fraud.
I understand that, but let me get back to this, the admission and Tricord's admission or failure to deny the request for admission, I think, which the trial court found was binding, is binding only on Tricord, is that right?
That is correct.
And you were trying to prove, and the trial court found you did not prove, a CUFTA claim against Brandon too, is that correct?
That's what the trial court said,
okay.
Yes.
And you're challenging that fact. But what is the effect of the admission or the failure of Tricord to deny the request for admission as upon Brandon 2? Does that have any effect on the claim against Brandon 2?
If it has any effect, let's bifurcate the transfers. The transfer that occurred after the Liz pendants, it could have been to me, you, anybody, total good faith, but the Liz pendants would have, by law, put us on notice that it was being challenged as a fraudulent transfer. So the transfer that occurred after our Liz pendants, Brandon 2 cannot avoid any type of liability by saying they are in good faith for full value.
I understand that's your contention, and I'm trying to get at a different point. My different point is the effect of the admission by Tricord is irrelevant, is it not, as to your claim against Brandon 2?
Not to the one with the list pendants, because they take subject to whatever the outcome of the lawsuit is, and the claim on a fraudulent conveyance is always against the fraudulent transferor. The fraudulent transferee is either held to the consequences or not held to the consequences. If you come under actual fraud, we don't have to prove Tricord's financial net worth. We just have to prove that they were intended to hinder, delay, and defraud.
And if Tricord admits that, and as they did here,
right,
then what's the effect of that admission on Brandon 2? That relieves you of the burden to prove that the transfer is fraudulent? Brandon 2 is stuck with that admission? Is that
well,
the...
I guess, to answer your question, I think yes, they cannot disprove what the transferor admitted. They can come in as an affirmative defense, as any fraudulent transferee can, and say good faith and adequate consideration. And that would be an affirmative defense available to them. That's how they would escape the liability. Otherwise, it's not proving good or bad on the transferee. It's proving good or bad on the transferor. So, you know, at this point in time, we then have the fact that the court never discussed the consequences of what happened to the $550,000 of consideration. What the trial court did was, in effect, rewrite the promissory note. The promissory note clearly was not a Brandon II loan. And so, as a matter of law, I don't think you can sit there and rewrite it and say, this is consideration. Now I'm answering Judge Connolly's question about what I'm going to call the first three. Brandon II did have a right to come in effect, challenge the fraudulent conveyance by saying we gave full and adequate consideration and we were good faith.
Well, pardon me, Mr. Coleman, I understand that, but that's an affirmative defense, right?
That's correct. That's their affirmative defense.
Yeah, under 388-109, they can say, although the court may have found, although Tricord may have admitted that it was a fraudulent transfer because Tricord admitted its own intent, nonetheless, we're able to come in and say, do not void this transfer to us because we acted in good faith and we gave reasonably equivalent value. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right.
So they have that full right. The problem is the note can't sustain it for a number of reasons. One, Mr. Stoner, who is the holder of the note and the lender, says that note still exists. At the time of trial, he said, it still exists. It's my guarantee that I personally have three men personally obligated to me to pay me. Well, how could that note have been canceled as consideration for transfers of 2 years earlier and still fully exist? Now, with respect to the other arguments, as to partnership, the issue of partnership was very material. I wanted to prove an insider. Ms. Horan was always annoyed that this group of four men could get together, form a couple corporations, do some deeds, and suddenly she thought she was selling to Tricord with $780,000 down paid on $1.3 million. And she said, fine, I know they've got $500,000 worth of assets there. And then through sleight of hand and no consideration, because statutorily they were required to put the consideration on the documentary fee, and there was none. It's a penal statute. For $40, they got rid of hundreds of thousands of dollars of property. But the partnership, you know, they try to contend that I'm saying Tricord's no longer the debtor. Tricord's the debtor. Tricord was the debtor, the partnership debtor, and the other partner is jointly and severally liable.
But you're saying this is partnership property. That seems at odds with your CUFTA claim. I mean, it's fundamentally inconsistent theory, isn't it?
With what?
With your CUFTA claim. I mean, you're saying CUFTA is based on Tricord's the property owner and it transfers to Brandon II. Now your argument is this is really property, partnership property the whole time.
Right, but I think you can try to defraud creditors even between partners. I don't see them mutually exclusive. I find that they both owed the partnership obligation, but they also tried to defraud creditors by documenting transfers out. Yes, they violated both acts, but I don't believe one stands independent of the other. I think they both can stand.
Let me ask you a question about that, if I may, Mr. Coleman. If they were partners from the beginning, in other words, they were liable, under your theory, they were liable from the beginning, then you can't have a fraudulent transfer back and forth between them because they were always liable. And then, so I think Judge Connolly's question is, if they're liable together from the beginning, how can they be liable under a CUFTA claim later?
Okay, I don't see any inconsistency. I think that you can, in effect, sign a note like Tricord. They owe it under contract law under the note. If it's in a partnership transaction, they owe it as a partner also. And if they then fraudulently convey assets, they impose tort liability or statutory fraudulent conveyance liability. So I think they can be alternative claims and all can stand together. And the general rule is alternative claims, but only one satisfaction.
Mr. Coleman, can you clarify for me, did your complaint allege that Tricord and Brandon II were partners as to the note?
We discovered this information shortly before trial. insofar as the actual partnership. We knew that there was inner dealings, and they, we knew that they were transferring assets. And then ultimately, they admitted at trial, and the trial court found the partnership. I would reserve my short amount of time.
Certainly. You've got about 2 minutes and 40 seconds. Thank you. And counsel, just to let you know, you and your co-counsel keep track of your time. I'm not going to step in, okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Nathan Kiever, and I represent the appellee, Brandon Two, in this case. The promissory note that was the basis of the plaintiff's claims was between Tricord and Horan. They're mischaracterizing it as a seller finance note at this point. You hear this number 1.3 coming in. You heard counsel just say that his client received some money. She did not receive any money. She was a contract holder only. The money that my client put into the transaction, the $780,000, went directly to the landowners that had it. They had the Moran property. She never had title to the Moran or the Jefferson property, which are the properties mentioned in that promissory note.
Even so, Mr. Kiever, isn't it fair to say that it is Ms. Horan's claim that you owe her, or your client owes her $550,000?
She never made that claim at trial. And that claim, the only way they brought us into this case was the idea that the properties then that were briefly titled in Tricord were transferred over, and my client, Brandon Two, ultimately ended up with them. So that she brought them into the case through the Fraudulent Transfer Act. And that was the only claim that was made against them. The court made detailed findings about the fraudulent transfer, said there was not a fraudulent transfer, and we were out of the case.
Let me ask you a question here, if I may. I may be jumping the gun, and I apologize for interrupting you early, but let's go to this issue of the admissions of Tricord. They're deemed conclusive as far as Tricord is concerned. And I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Coleman. Doesn't that mean that we now have an admission that there was a fraudulent transfer in this case, because there was an admission that there was a transfer with the intent to hinder or delay? Thus, isn't your role here to say, okay, I've got this affirmative defense, and I can raise this affirmative defense, and if I show good faith and reasonably equivalent value, you can't get at the property. Isn't that where we are now?
I would say no, that isn't where we are, because those findings were not binding on us, and those admissions were not binding on us. The court made it very clear it was not looking to bind us with those admissions at the start of the trial when all this was discussed. But even if they were binding, the court made specific findings that the $780,000 was to Tricord's benefit, and that was supported by the evidence, Exhibit 17, Exhibit UU, testimony of Mr. Stonard, testimony of the Tricord principals. All of those supported the court's finding that we did give adequate consideration for that property, and it was to Tricord's benefit, and that's why we received it. The court also made a specific finding that the transactions, our part of these transactions, were all in good faith. And so both of those, even if we did have that burden, we met that burden through those findings.
But let me ask that. The promissory note is Exhibit 16, I think, as Mr. Coleman said, executed December of 06. And Brandon Two is not a party to that note. And tell me, it's a $780,000 note. Is that right?
That's the individual's note?
Yeah.
The individual's note is not what the court found was the consideration for this. What the court found was the consideration for this was the fact that it allowed Tricord to fulfill its obligations under the sales contracts for the land. Tricord had entered into these land purchase agreements that it did not have the money to meet, or at least wasn't set up to. The $780,000 that allowed it to fulfill its obligations under those contracts to buy the Moran property, to buy the Canterbury property, came from Brandon Two, LLC. That was the benefit that
And in what form did it come? How did Brandon Two convey that $780,000 value to Tricord?
It went straight from the title company, or straight to the title company at closing, and then straight to the landowners. So the Canterbury property, which was owned by Ms. Horn, got her money at closing, even though it was Tricor that was obligated under that contract. And it was Brandon Two's $780,000 and went straight to the Morans for the Moran property. So it was transferred directly to the landowners. The only thing that happened was at closing, since Tricord was there and their name was on the contract, the title it was titled in Tricord, and then Tricord had to split off a small piece as part of the deal with Moran back to them. When they got that subdivision done and split that piece off, the properties were transferred over to Brandon Two LLC, as was contemplated from the beginning between those parties.
So what role does $500,000 case?
As far as Brandon Two's concerned, it didn't even know about the $550,000 note. This was a fight between Horan and Tricord, two brokers, basically, of land contracts. And they were fighting over whether or not Tricord owed an extra $550,000 to Horan for the transfer of those contracts, not the transfer of the property, the transfer of the contract.
But let me follow up. I know the law recognized a lot of fictions, but you say Brandon Two didn't even know about that. Three signatories of Exhibit 18 are Brandon Two.
No, not that promissory note. That's the $780,000 promissory note.
No, there's a letter of intent, Exhibit 18, the owners of Tricord Development Group, LLC, which are Yannick, Baker, and Brandon.
That's not Brandon Two. That's Tricord.
I get that, but you're saying Brandon Two doesn't know about it, but what is Brandon Two? Who are the Brandon Two principals?
Brandon Two is Stonard. Jerry Brandon has nothing to do with Brandon Two. And that was, it's a confusing point in this case, but Jerry Brandon is...
Then the promissory note of December 29th, 06 is for the benefit of Stonard, signed by these three principals.
As an individual, yes.
I just think there's a little bit of a fiction here when you say Brandon Two had no idea of the obligation when, in fact, Brandon Two, the principals, and Stonard are all one and the same people that are involved in this, aren't they? I mean, isn't that where we're not talking about...
It's different. The $780,000, which is the about amount of the promissory note that you're looking at, that individual guarantee, that's the amount Brandon Two put into this deal. That was the $780,000 cash that it put in. It knew about the cash it was putting into it. There's this other $550,000 deal, sort of side deal between the brokers, Tricord and Horan, that Brandon Two knew nothing about. Brandon Two knew it was buying property for development. And it bought property for development. It got the property.
So let's assume we carry this fiction through and we say, okay, hypothetically, Brandon Two knew nothing of the $550,000 note. Now, Tricord certainly did, right?
Right.
So that goes back to my original question. Isn't this argument that you're providing me an argument that says Brandon Two was acting in good faith and provided reasonably equivalent value?
Is
that a fair assessment of your argument or not?
It is. I think okay. It supports the court's findings in that regard.
Okay.
Did the court make those findings by saying that Brandon Two had the burden by preponderance to show the statutory exemption, or did it say that the plaintiff had not proven her CUFTA claim by a preponderance?
It went through the elements of the CUFTA claim and made the findings in that way.
And basically the finding was the plaintiff has not proven her claim.
That's correct.
But if the Tricord admission is given effect as against Brandon Two, and you go to the 108-109 affirmative defense, then it's your burden and Brandon Two's burden to prove the elements of an affirmative defense. Is that not right?
Well, if they had not proven the other elements, you know, if they had not failed to prove the rest of the elements of their CUFTA claim as well, then I see your point. You know, yes, the court could have looked at it from the opposite angle as well and said, no, there's a different burden here.
Yeah. And if that were the case, we'd have to remand, wouldn't we?
If the courts, if you said yes, they met all of the other elements, and therefore the court wasn't weighed correctly, then yes.
No, or if we said, and that's why I'm kind of stuck on the same question, if we were to say that the effect of the Tricord admission is that this was a fraudulent transfer to transferee Brandon Two, and if Brandon Two is then stuck with it because the intent of the transferor is the dispositive point, is not? And at that point, you'd have a fraudulent transfer, then the burden would be on you, as Brandon Two, to prove the elements of an affirmative defense.
Well, I don't agree with all of the premise, but yeah. If all those premises were correct, then yeah.
And tell me you don't agree with the premise that the admission should be...
Should be binding against Brandon, yeah. too. And I don't agree that it's only the transferor that's looked at under that statute, because it's the statute says it's going to look at whether this was a fraudulent conveyance and take action against the transferee. So it's the transferee. That's how the transferee, in this case, Brandon, too, got pulled into this action.
But isn't the way that that CUFTA, that particular actual intent fraudulent conveyance statute work, isn't the way that the statute's set up is first you look at the transferor. Did the transferor act with fraudulent intent? And if there's actual intent to do so, doesn't that end that inquiry? And then you take the next step, okay, transferee, what about you? Isn't that the way it's supposed to work?
Yes, but when we're talking about these admissions and who these admissions are binding on, the question is the remedy that's being enforced is against the transferee. So you can't say, I got admissions against the transferor, so all I'm going to look at as a transferee or transferor, even though the remedy is coming against the transferee.
I understand that. I understand that. But if you're saying, but you get to raise your defense. You get to say, hold the phone. We've done nothing wrong here. We've acted in good faith, and we provided reasonably equivalent value. And so the first finding of actual intent to hinder or delay doesn't deal with you. It deals with Tricor. And then once that's determined, isn't the way the statute works, is that it then shifts the burden to you to say, okay, we understand that Tricor may have had this intent, but you can't void the transfer because we're without sin here.
Yeah, but I see your point. The issue I see is you can't get there through an admission of just the transfer or that if they had proved that against us, and they have the burden of proving that, they don't get to get away from their burden of proving that against us and shift that burden by getting an admission against somebody that's not us.
Let me get this one. Yeah. And I'm sorry, I know you're cutting into your colleagues' time with questions, but let me get it this way. The statutory threshold is, did the debtor make the transfer with the intent to hinder, delay, et cetera, right? And so the debtor, that's Tricord, has admitted that, yes, we made that transfer with the intent to hinder and delay. You're saying that you, as the transferee, should be able to say, no, the debtor did not make that transfer. Despite the fact that they've admitted that, we have the right to hold the plaintiff to her element of proof on that one because we are not the admittee.
Yes, they've admitted it as to themselves. They can't put on evidence contrary to that to themselves.
Right.
But that doesn't relieve the plaintiff from putting on evidence against us.
And they still have to.
They want that remedy. They still have to. If they want that remedy, they still have to put on evidence against us.
Okay, because we've asked so many questions, stop the clock, please. What we're going to do here is we're going to add 2.5 minutes for you, counsel, for Yannonek, and Mr. Coleman, we will give you an additional 2.5 minutes also. Okay? All right. Please proceed. I'm sorry. So if you'd set the clock back to 5.
Yeah, one second.
Certainly. Please remember to add 2.5 minutes to Mr. Coleman's time at the end. Counsel, technology is a wonderful thing.
Please. I was going to make the same comment, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Your Honor, may it please the court, I'm David Krall, appearing on behalf of Brian Yannonek. I'm a little bit of on factual issues, I'm a little bit of a disadvantage since I was not the trial attorney in this matter. And I would apologize also to the court because I made a statement in my brief that the transcript had not been sent up. We checked out, my office checked out the file. Some reason we didn't get the transcript, so when I wrote the brief, I didn't realize it had been sent up. So I apologize. I wasn't trying to mislead anybody there.
No harm done. We know that we have the transcript.
I'll try to just jump here very quickly. Mr. Yannonek was found, initially, found that he had liability because he was held in default. and I will talk about it, and that was the cross appeal, is to set aside the default in the event that this gets remanded. I don't believe it needs to get to that point, but that said, the only liability that was found at trial was on the promissory note, which is against Tricor. There were no allegations against Yannick or any of the individual defendants for the promissory note claim, other than the now there's a conspiracy claim in the cup, which goes to the covenant claim. I think the court was very, very clear, and they said Rule 54 does not permit relief based on issues not squarely presented. And that's the whole problem. When you start looking at what was pled and apparently what was presented at trial, even the trial court admitted when he was talking about it, when he was ruling on the fraud claims, he didn't understand where the fraud was or what the alleged fraud was. I think the court's comment was does not identify the alleged fraud except to say they made false representations. Well, as the court properly noted, the false representations have to be intended, no intent to perform at the time you make them, and there is no proof regarding that even submitted. There's none in the record whatsoever that Yannick or any of the individual defendants, or even Tricord for that matter, except they've got those admissions out there, that they intended to defraud at the time they entered into these contracts. It's just a land contract that didn't quite work out the way everybody wanted it to. Unfortunately, that's business. And by the way, that finding was not disputed in the brief by Horan here. So, well, let's look at the Cuffta claim. And this, the court was very particular. They spent over two pages in its findings on the Cuffta claim. And they went through, the court went through each of the 11 individual items of that claim. And for the most of them, whether it was substantially all the aspects, no evidence presented. Whether the debtor absconded, no. And it goes on generally no on each one of these claims. Those are findings by the court that the court made.
Now those are the badges of fraud, which may be in may or may not be indicative of actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud. If the party admits that it intended to delay or defraud, isn't it so that it's not necessary to prove the badges of fraud, at least against that party?
Believe that's true. But against the other parties, because they're not held to those admissions, it is. And so to get to Yannick and the other individual defendants, they have to be able to prove that there were these badges of fraud as to them to have a conspiracy to get to find liability on their behalf. The other thing that's pointed out here, several of these transfers were done long before the case was ever brought. And, so nobody was hiding anything at this point in time. Without the Cuffta claim, there can be no conspiracy claim because the two go hand in hand. I'll spend the last minute just mention the cross appeal. If the case is remanded, Yannick had answered. He filed an answer to the original response. When he did not, he maintains to this day, he never got notice that he had to file an answer to the amended complaint. The amended complaint is admitted in the brief is substantially the same as the first complaint. It adds the Cuffta claim, but that's about it. And so he didn't answer.
But isn't this a deferential, my problem with the cross appeal is this a very deferential standard review? The court made finding to the contrary. Wasn't there, even after the default, the court had a phone conference, I guess, where your client participated and was told, I guess he was pro se at the time, that you better act quickly if you want to set it aside? He did not act quickly.
No, he did. He filed within 5 days, and that included a weekend. And he's in Colorado Springs. So.
All right, but what about, all right, fair enough. And then the notice issue, though, the court found to the contrary, didn't it? Didn't the court find that he had actual notice?
No, the court never addressed the notice issue. There was never any hearing scheduled, never notices sent out for the hearing, nothing. And Part B of the rule absolutely mandates it's a void. Any judgment without the hearing, without proper notice of the hearing, is void. And the application of the clerk, and I don't think a clerk can do this at this point, the application of the clerk was 2 days before the default was entered. So clearly we didn't have 3 days. So
thank you, Mr. Crawl.
Thank you very much.
I not only appreciate questions, but I consider the extra time a real bonus, so thank you.
Well, it's only fair, Mr. Okay. Coleman.
Let me straighten out a few issues. You asked a point-blank question about the promissory note and the cash. You got a false answer. The transaction was simple. The $785,000, there was a money transfer in December of 2006. It corresponds with the one promissory note that was presented as the consideration theory. Contrary to counsel's statement, there was never money put in at the subsequent closings. What happened was the $785,000 and the $550,000 was to acquire what's called the Canterbury property, which was owned by Ms. Horan. It was not owned by third parties. It was owned by her. Part of the Canterbury property in April was traded to obtain the Moran property. No new money. Contrary to the statement you just heard, and I've never heard that in the trial court, in their brief they state that on page 15, I had a moment to find it, they admit, well, they contend it was Brandon II that transferred the $780,000. We all know that it was a Stoner, but that's the only time they contend they transferred any money whatsoever. I was flabbergasted by the response you heard. The trial court's judgment on pages 5 and 13 say $785,000 was transferred. And again, it's to the December transaction. So let's not change the facts at the last minute. What happened here is Stonard advanced money to three individuals so they could capitalize the company. He then takes the note so that he's got some personal claim against them. They then use that money to pay the down payment to Horan and take back the $550,000 note.
So does Horan get the $780,000?
Yes, she did get $780,000. No dispute about that. She got that for Canterbury, and Canterbury and the property rights were valued at $1,330,000. We're here complaining that they diverted all the assets so we couldn't collect the balance.
That's a seller take back. You call a seller take back $550,000 note. There's quibbles about semantics, but there's no dispute that she was out $550,000. Tricord defaulted on its obligation under the note.
That's correct. It's the promissory note was, I'm just, you know, referring to a seller carry back. So I just wanted to correct that. Now you've heard that on the fraudulent transfer, the trial court did not give any explanation of how it arrived at its decision. Yes, it went through all the elements and said, this badger fraud, that badger fraud, this badger fraud, that badger fraud, but never explained how it gets over Colorado law, which says that you don't have to prove all badges of fraud. And he specifically never addressed how do you even rely on that when you've already said liability has been effectively been determined by the admission. I was baffled. Yes, he was predominantly right on finding six badges of fraud. I think there were two more that he didn't address, but that's neither here nor there. We had a admission.
That's what I'm still stuck on, though. It's an admission by Tricord. What effect, if any, does that have against Brandon II? I'm still don't see how that admission has any effect against Brandon II.
Again, we need to distinguish to the one that Brandon II knew about, because in theory, the Liz pendants makes them knowledgeable.
All right, so apart from the Liz pendants, after October, there'd be prior to three.
And that's the Moran property. So that entire property, you know, is subject to the admissions. As to the other ones, I believe the law is that you are to stop the fraudulent transfers. So the whole focus is on what did the transferor do? Did he intend to defraud? In this case, we know for a certainty they did based on the admissions and the findings, which haven't been challenged. If he intended to defraud, what are the consequences? One of the remedies is that you set aside the transfer, or you make the transfer subject to our $550,000. All of that is stated under the statute. And yes, any innocent buyer, if that's where the statute ended, would be plumb out of luck. They picked the wrong guy to deal with, and that every buyer would be subject to those sanctions. The legislature decided that sounds a little harsh, because if the buyer can prove that he was in good faith and paid fair value, he shouldn't be held accountable. So to answer your question, the statutory framework is exactly as we've urged, and that is we win if we prove the fraudulent conveyance. However, we can be trumped by an affirmative defense. But if they don't trump us with that affirmative defense, I don't have to prove anything against the transferee. And therefore,
you've got to prove there was a fraudulent conveyance. You're saying that you've proved that, but that automatically the automatic effect of admission by the transferor, the debtor, is binding on the transferee. And I'm just not finding authority for that.
Binding on the transaction. The transaction is now subject to the Fraudulent Conveyance Act. I have proved that the conveyances are within the scope of the statute and that the statute applies. And then, so that we don't impose detriment on an innocent party, they have their affirmative defense. So I believe that with the admission, we have proved every aspect of the fraudulent conveyance, and we have to stand ready to defend an affirmative defense if it is proven.
Your time, Mr. Coleman.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you all for your time. We appreciate you. I know some of you had to travel a long way to get here, and we certainly appreciate you coming. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. We shall now call the next case on our docket for this afternoon, which is Sawyer versus Pelfrey. And if counsel for that case would come up and get set up as counsel for the prior case, please. Thank you.